G'day expats, James Ridley here, and I'm joined with my co-host today, Jeremy Harper from H Finance. Just doing another expat chat. Obviously there's a few up there now. We're just doing another one to cover off on a few questions from our recent webinar that we conducted with Jeremy about the mortgage process for an Australian expat and what they need to be aware of. That's also on our YouTube channel as well. The recording will go up there soon. But we thought we'd use this opportunity to do another episode, talk about some general Q&As that we received from clients, I suppose attendees, and essentially just a bit of a market update. But a short summary, I guess, on Jeremy. Obviously, you've been running H Finance for a while now. The main focus is Australian expats, that's right.
Yep.
And then you're a former expat as well. Where were you living before?
So living Upper East Side, Manhattan in New York.
Oh, wow, okay, yep.
Yeah. So that was very interesting, I think, at the moment. Right now it's about -4 degrees, I checked, so definitely a bit different to the sunny blue skies at the moment.
Yeah, that's right, on the Gold Coast, but unfortunately, actually at the moment, we've got all the rural sort of flies going around, which is causing havoc and wreaking havoc, especially from an air pollution point of view, but we digress. So former expat, living overseas, New York, that's great. So you've lived that expat experience, you know what it's like, you've been through a lot of probably the pain points that expats go through.
Yeah.
How long were you there for? Were you there for a long time, or was it more of a short stint, like 12 months or?
Yeah, so just a bit over 2 years.
Yeah,
so,
okay. Good stint.
Originally from born and bred in Melbourne.
Yep, yep.
Started as a CA accountant, worked in the Melbourne CBD.
Yep.
Tax and advisory, and then started working to industry accounting. And then started up H Finance as a mortgage broker.
Yeah.
And then from Melbourne, moved over to New York for a couple of years.
Yep.
And now back in Australia, living in Sydney.
Yeah, okay, wonderful. I mean, the fact that you're a CA accountant as well, that's great. I mean, I do think that sometimes, depending on the industry, you know, I suppose in the past I've seen mortgage brokers, financial planners, obviously they've got a bit of a rap at the moment, post-Royal Commission, but accountants are always sort of that individual that people are happy talking to, that sort of a reassurance or reassuring, you know, sort of advice that they give. So the fact that you're a CA accountant as well, that's huge.
Yeah.
Do you ever have sort of conversations about tax, property, anything like that with clients, or not really?
Just generally.
Yeah.
I always try and give a little bit of general advice, and then I'll just say, look, you know, go back to your accountant and have a bit more of a chat around them.
Yeah.
And myself, just through my experience being in the US, having to file with the IRS and having to deal with, it's three levels of state, you know, federal, state, and city.
Yep.
Understanding that those sort of tax pain points and having to file back here. So I kind of can just draw my own experience a little bit.
Yeah, and you make an important point just before. Guys, as always, a bit of a general advice disclaimer. Anything we say today, it's all general advice. There's no personal advice given here. If you want, obviously, personal advice, please do engage us or Jeremy for the mortgage side. You know, just take this as general and nothing personal. One of the points you mentioned, the IRS. I mean, I hate the IRS. Worst taxation authority in the world. I'm happy quoting it. I'm happy saying it just because I see all the pain points that our clients have to go through. The fact that you've got the federal level and then the state level. Obviously, depending on the state you live in, you know, it's going to depend whether you have mounting pain points. Obviously, if you're in Texas, not really an issue, those sort of things. But California, that's terrible.
Yeah.
So, completely understand there. A general summary of what we're going to touch base on today. Again, just touching base on probably the recent main residence exemption, the resurgence of that bill, now that they've updated, add a few caveats in there. And then, you know, the general state of maybe interest rates in the future, RBA decisions, how that's looking. And then I've got quite a few questions that I do want to drill you with, just from some clients as well as some attendees that sent through. Just to have a bit more of an understanding of, you know, getting that mortgage when you're an expat and, you know, especially a lot of, not necessarily pitfalls, but things you need to be aware of.
Yeah.
So let's jump into it. So, you know, let's touch base on the RBA decision. You know, you gave me some good facts just before about how we've been on 1.5%, or was it, for almost 3 years?
Maybe 3 years, yeah. So then June this year, they came through the first cut.
Yep.
July, and then they went again August. So we're now down at 75 points.
Yep. Yeah, okay.
October. So down at 75 points. You know, a lot of the experts out there thought it was going to be November.
Yep.
Went a month early. So
it's
interesting to see what sort of happens before the end of the year. Maybe there'll be another cut just before Christmas, particularly with what's happening with the fires. They want to maybe get some positive news out to the market.
Yeah. I think that's, it's a good way to look at it. I mean, the fact that we're at 0.75, and I suppose the majority of lenders, I would assume, are passing them on, those cuts, which is good. And if it gets down to 0.5, you know, say we receive that cut in December, I mean, that's huge. I mean, and I really wonder how long they can maintain being at 0.5. You know,
yeah.
When does relevant data about, you know, economic growth, unemployment rates, when does that come back up? I know when I was listening to a podcast the other day of Shane Oliver, so he's the head economist at AMP, he was saying that we are likely to see another rate cut, probably the next 3 months, and then, you know, we could see the Australian dollar drop it to 65 cents. It's likely it might stay there for a while, but all in all, saying that next year, you know, we're still going to see growth. There's still going to be growth in the economy. It's not going to be quick, but there's still growth. That's the mantra. It's slow and steady, which is good to see. But interest rate cuts, I mean, what else do they sort of have left on the table to do? You know, quantitative easing, those sort of things, printing their
own money. Yeah, and I think it's important to understand that, you know, the big banks are under, if you've looked at the financials that have just come out recently, their cost of funding is under extreme pressure. You know, what they can't pass on the full 25 points if there's another cut, because they will then have to impact the savings that are within their own bank. So if you look at, you know, if I look at my own bank statements, the return you're getting just having your cash in a bank account, it's razor thin at the moment. And I'm sure your clients, particularly maybe the savers that are on that later stage of their life, they're getting hurt because having money in term deposits, bank accounts, it's hurting those guys.
Yeah.
So I guess the RBA needs to kind of weigh both of them up and see how that's going to impact the economy overall, because it does hurt people on the other side as well. Mm. But on, I guess, on the interest rate piece, you know, you're seeing lenders pass your NIM within 18, 20 points. That's their internal modeling that they do. We're seeing on a fixed rate, so obviously you've got the variable rates and you're fixed. So just for the viewers out there that might know, the variable rate with that lender will generally get the rate get passed through, or, you know, the rate will get increased per the variable. If you're on a fixed rate with that lender, well, you've locked in for that period of time. So if you're on, let's say, a 2 or 3 year fixed loan, and the bank passes on a 15 point cut or increases, you don't get that benefit or that expense. So that will lock in. So what you're seeing from a pricing point of view, is a lot of the 2 and 3 year fix are sort of anywhere between 20 to 22 points cheaper than that variable rate offered by that same lender. So it's sort of a little bit of, if you want to lock that in, you'll get that benefit up front, but if the RBA cuts and they pass on a rate down the track,
you're not going to get that benefit, obviously.
Correct, for that 2 or 3 year period.
I mean, a question that, you know, I'll ask now before I forget, having a fixed rate loan, can you break that loan? I mean, can you refinance? Is there a better, what's the process, fees, things?
Yeah, so look, if you refinance a variable loan, you'll pay with that lender what you call a discharge fee. Generally, it's $300, $350. It'll be on the loan contract of that particular lender, but that's sort of the rough quote. If you are breaking a fixed loan, there will be a break fee. It's calculated by the date you entered that fixed loan, and then the date you're trying to exit, and they'll quote you. And that's based on their lending and what it costs them to lend out to you. So if it's a large loan, you know, you can get quoted $10,000-$11,000 with that lender. Yeah, if it's near the expiry and it's a small loan, again, it depends on when you enter the loan. It could be a couple of dollars, so it could make sense. So in that scenario, best bets called bank, say, if I was to get a payout today, what would that, give me a rough quote.
Yeah, okay. I didn't realize that it could be that high. I thought it, you know, my interpretation that, yes, you know, higher fees, but I suppose, if you've just started a fixed loan, you've got another 3 years left on it, the fees can be that high, which
and
is substantial.
And again, it depends on that cost of funding for the bank when you took that out.
Yeah, okay. The other item that I mentioned earlier was the main residence exemption. Obviously, this is a huge pain point for a lot of expats. You know, we blew past that transition period of 30th of June 2019, and then they've brought it back in, and I'm just sort of bringing it up because they've brought it back in now. They're saying the new transition period is 30th of June 2020, but they've thrown in a few caveats. The caveats that they've thrown in is, you know, someone that's considered an excluded foreign person or foreign resident, and then the other caveat is life events. So, I mean, just mentioning this because it's just so crucial, it's so damaging. Whilst the legislation, it acts in a prospective manner, you know, it's purely retrospective in nature. So just means that they're taxing us on years and years that we've owned these properties as main residences. But the caveats that they've included is essentially, you know, if you've been overseas for a period of greater than 6 years as a non-resident, then you count it as an excluded foreign person. And the life events that have included is terminal medical diagnosis of yourself, your spouse, or a child that's 18 years or younger.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had to sell the property, then you know you don't have to declare as a taxable event. If you pass away, or your spouse passes away, or again, a child passes away under the age of 18. And then the last one is essentially if there's a divorce within that 6 year period. So the main reasons why they've introduced these caveats is, I guess, a preservation of capital.
Yeah.
Obviously, the first two, medical diagnosis, which is damaging terminal from a terminal point of view, trying to preserve that capital because obviously living costs are going to go up to service that depending on the diagnosis, those sort of things. But regardless, just as damaging as the old legislation, someone having to pay capital gains tax on a property, that they've owned for say 15 years, they lived in it for say 10 years in Sydney, which is quite common to be honest, Sydney, Melbourne, and then they move overseas, they rent it out for 5 years, they want to sell it, but they sell it after that 30th of June 2020 as a non-resident, paying CDT on it all the way back until they first purchased it. So really scary in terms of the potential large tax bills that could come about. But again, just mentioning that it is at draft stage, it's meant to be on the order of business in November now, so we won't know too much more until December, hopefully.
Yeah.
But again, a very short window for expats to consider selling, considering that the transition period is 30th of June 2020.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're refinancing or you're engaged by someone to refinance, do they ever bring up topics around the tax item, CGT, main residence?
Yeah, so I guess what I would say around if they're looking at selling whilst they're abroad,
yeah,
that could be something, maybe a question would be, okay, well, why?
Yep.
If it's purely, excuse me, if they've got an existing mortgage on that property back in Australia and they're selling because it's a cash flow issue, so
yep,
maybe the rent they're getting on their Sydney property is not covering the cost of the mortgage,
yep,
so they don't want to have to every month whilst living in the US or living in Europe,
mm-hmm,
put money towards the property.
Yep.
Maybe an option could be if they've just left that mortgage as it is, they might be paying principal interest.
Yep.
Can we look at refinancing and maybe get an interest only loan?
Yeah, okay.
And that's going to extend out the cash flow. What does that look like from a monthly income versus expenses? And maybe that could be a solution whilst they're living abroad.
Yep. Yeah, okay. No, that's very interesting. Listen, let's dive into some questions,
yep,
that some clients and viewers have sent through. Some pretty important ones here, and I think a lot of them will sing true home to a lot of people as well. So first one I've got here is, I'm currently with a big bank in Australia. It's not one of the big four, but my interest rate is 6%, which is,
yep,
huge. Is this too high considering the current market, or is there a guide on a rough rate I should have on an investment property? Pretty open question, but a 6% interest rate, what's your thoughts on that?
6% is far too high,
yep,
particularly in this environment. You can see a lot of lenders that we can get Australian expats, so provided an Australian citizen living abroad,
yep,
and they can service that loan under that lender, you can still qualify for pricing that's exactly the same as if you and I were to get investment property,
yep,
whilst living in Australia.
Yep.
So, to set some examples, you should be looking at sort of low 3%,
yeah, okay,
around that sort of range.
Yep.
You got to keep in mind the larger and even the small banks do take advantage of people long term being that loan for a number of years because that's where they make their margin on the back end.
Yep.
And that if they understand that you're living out overseas, then they also understand it might be difficult for you to move lenders, so they've got a little bit of a hold over you as a borrower.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, when I saw that come through, I thought 6%,
yeah,
I nearly fell off my chair. And I mean, I even think anything over 5% is too much. I mean, generally, most clients that I come across, they'll have something between 3 to 4.
Yeah.
Which, that's pretty standard, to be honest.
Yeah.
So, there's a few factors that could play in there because they do mention it's an investment property. We don't know the size of the loan on there, the LVR.
Could be interest only.
Yeah.
Yep.
So there's a few factors that obviously play into it, but 6%, just way too high.
Yeah.
I mean, they're taking the piss there. Okay, so next question here. I've been away for 15 years now and have about 150K I'd like to use for a property purchase. I haven't lodged a tax return since I left. Is this going to be an issue with me getting a mortgage in Australia? It's a good question.
It is a good question. So depending on the credit team that pick up the file and the bank, but
yep,
they might ask the question, can we see your last Australian tax returns?
Yep.
You know, provided if you've lodged a no return necessary when you left, then that should satisfy that requirement. And really, if you're not generating Australian income, you know, if you don't have an existing Australian property or have to file because you might have a HECS debt, then that's fine because you're earning income overseas and you're a non-Australian tax resident.
Yeah, okay. I mean, a common thing there as well is, you know, depending on the account they've seen, they're probably going, okay, you've got no Australian sourced income. I'm going to put you down as return not necessary going forward. So that's why you might not have obviously an Australian tax return. But most commonly, if there's been a period without tax returns, you can engage an accountant to go on the ATO portal on your behalf and, you know, tick the relevant boxes to say return not necessary or non-resident lodgement. And that's something that they'll bill you for, obviously. But by the sounds of it, it depends on the lender policy.
Correct. And obviously, you know, if you're going down the pathway of purchasing investment property, you're going to have Australian rental income, so then your Australian tax obligation is going to change in the future.
Yeah, of course.
Start reporting on that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Next question, moving on. How often should I consider refinancing? That's a good question.
So every 2 years, try and really review your loan and the interest rates and the fees you're getting charged.
Yep.
Look, the first point of call is to go back to that lender and negotiate with them and see if they can bring you in line with what they're offering new customers.
Yep.
Quite often, I'm sure people would understand, they see on TV or website, come to our bank, you know, we're going to offer new clients this rate, you're on a completely different rate. You know, there is that, they call it a lazy tax, oh, we're doing take advantage that you've been on the book for a few years. So see how close you can get to that rate they're offering.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's in line with the market, potentially you don't have to refinance.
Yeah.
But every 2 years, if they don't come to the party, you can look at refinancing.
Yeah, and I suppose mortgages are those things that we have for a very long time.
Yep.
And I dare say a lot of people, you know, that they are lazy in the sense that, okay, I've got a mortgage, I'm just going to accept it for what it is, I'm just going to keep paying it.
Yeah.
And they won't look to refinance because maybe the process of when they originally got the loan was painful. You know?
Yep.
They maybe worked with the bank, which made it really hard, and therefore they don't want to go through that, you know, one or two month process of refinancing, and they're just sort of going to accept it, bite the bullet, just keep paying it.
Yeah, the only thing about if you're continuously refinancing, it's important to note that, you know, a standard mortgage is 30 years.
Yeah.
So you really don't want to be continuously extending out the 30-year facility.
Yeah.
So making sure that your repayments are just as high, maybe if not a little bit higher than what you were paying, just so you can smash out that mortgage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose you've got to remember that when you're refinancing, there's always those little fees you incur, discharges, those sort of things. So, you know, if the new mortgage is, you know, a few bips or a few, you know, a significant percentage difference there, or your repayments, you're winding down the loan quicker, then it makes sense.
Correct.
So you really got to weigh up the pros and cons of refinancing. So that's good. So every 2 years there, guys. I suppose another one here. What's your opinion on another rate cut? Do you think we'll get one in the coming months? So I suppose, you know, we talked about that just briefly before, but client sent it through. Do you think we'll get another rate cut?
So yeah, I mean, I think if they're going to have one in the near future, it probably will be before Christmas, just to, as we said, maybe get everyone all excited and rushing to the shops before Christmas, and get a bit more activity going in the economy.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, especially with what's going on at the moment, not just obviously Queensland, but down in New South Wales, standing further down to Victoria, all these, you know, bushfires that are going on. It's the worst we've ever seen. I think I saw a post the other day on the socials where someone said that you compare, at the moment there's 950,000 hectares which have been burnt in Australia.
Yeah.
And you compare that to a fire, a damaging fire that occurred in the Amazon last year, which was only 150,000. So it puts things in perspective.
Yeah.
And they also think that we're not even at the worst point yet. I think it's going to get a lot worse due to the weather that's predicted. So it does make sense that governments can do that. They can, you know, put through policies like this where it's to provide a bit of relief. So if you're right, get more people spending money.
Yeah.
So help the economy. So I think that's important. So yeah, maybe next month. I reckon next 3 months, but next month does make sense in leading into Christmas. Another one here. Are you finding more people are buying in Australia now that the interest rates are low?
Yeah, so I guess you're seeing the first-time buyers are definitely coming to the market.
Yep.
There's a range of incentives that have already been out there for first-time buyers, but with the low rates,
yep,
Plus, with the proposed first-time buyer scheme that's going to come in 1 Jan next year,
yep.
basically the government's going to act as a guarantor.
Yeah, yep.
So instead of mum or dad using their property, provided you can qualify for the program,
yep.
you can get in with as little as 5% deposit.
Yep.
Okay. And not have to pay mortgage insurance. So we are seeing there's a lot of activity around there.
Yep.
But also we're seeing with the expats, you know, there's people in Hong Kong, people in London,
yep.
with Brexit, people in the US. So a lot of people are sort of reassessing their own situation around, you know, do we want to live abroad?
Yeah.
Because Australia is still seen as very much, particularly in property, very safe,
yep.
government's very safe. So yep. there's always that need to maybe now's the time we come back, maybe we purchase that property to come back to.
Yeah, you're right. And Australians, you know, we've always had a love affair with property.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious that, you know, we love from an investor point of view that we know what we pay for it when we first purchase it. We assume that's what it's worth over the next 5-10 years and it's going to go up in value. And then, you know, we love being oblivious to what it might actually be doing compared to, you know, say what our super account is changing every day, or
yeah.
an investment account or shares, whatever it might be. So we do have that love affair because we love being oblivious to what it might be worth.
Yeah.
I mean, people obviously that bought in, say, Sydney, you know, maybe a few years ago and then they've actually gone backwards, they're not happy. But yeah, you're right, we do love property, we see it as a safe investment because it's that physical asset.
Yeah.
So no, I completely understand that. So that's a good point you make there. And I think further on that would probably be a fact that, you know, I know for a fact that a lot of clients that are based in the US are considering property purchase in the near future because of the relative strength of the US dollar.
Yeah.
Purchasing power is a lot greater, and you said that before as well. They're making a good little return on their funds by transferring home to Australian dollars. Or maybe potentially parking in an offset account.
Yeah.
So you've got some options there as well. A good one here, I have a mortgage and I'm trying to understand what the difference between a redraw facility and an offset account is.
Yeah, so an offset account, if you, I guess if you log into internet banking and you've got the mortgage up in the front, or at the top,
yep.
and then below you've got what you call an offset account, it will look like a savings everyday bank account will have
yep.
a BSB and account number. And so for people who don't understand offset account, you can just imagine it's exactly like a bank account, except whatever the funds are sitting in the account, that's going to offset the interest charged on that variable loan that
yep.
you've got. So let's say it's a $500,000 variable loan, you have $50,000 in the offset account. Well, that lender's going to charge, provided it's linked, they will charge $450,000 interest, or sorry, interest on the $450 borrowings.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
And so for an expat, you could use the offset account to receipt your foreign transfers into.
Mm-hmm.
It'll, generally, you'll get a debit card. You can go to ATM, withdraw cash in Australia, use it to pay bills, receipt the rental income. So fully transactional account. Whereas a redraw account, if you log in, it will be a redraw function within the loan. So it will only have one loan.
Yep.
And let's say you have a $500,000 loan facility and you're being repaying more than the monthly minimums.
Yep.
So $2,000 a month, you're what you're meant to repay, you're being a good saver, you're paying off $2,500. You might have built up a redraw facility that you can draw down. So it might be $10,000 in there.
Yep.
You can go in there and redraw that out. So you just have to be mindful that, as you're saying, there's different tax considerations.
Yep.
Because you're redrawing borrowing, so mm-hmm. you're effectively creating a new borrowing event.
Yep.
Whereas the offset account is a savings account,
yeah.
essentially.
Yeah, so I mean, I can pull funds out of an offset account and use that for investing or even personal purchases because the loan balance is still there, it's still the original loan balance. The interest expense that increases is still a tax deduction if it's an investment.
Yeah.
So that's really good, whereas redraw, not so much. So that's an important factor, but that's a good outline there. Obviously, offset account, separate account altogether, doesn't impact from a tax point of view. Redraw it does in terms of, you know, you can't technically use the increase in interest expense. So double check that whenever you're getting a mortgage, and I suppose whether that's a mortgage feature you probably want.
Yeah, and just keep in mind that, you know, the redraw accounts is normally basic, so maybe you can get a slightly lower rate using a basic package.
Yep.
With a redraw, no offset, whereas an offset account you might have to pay an annual fee depending on the lender.
Yeah,
because it's a premium feature.
Yep.
Maybe that rate attached to it's slightly higher, depends on the lender and how they'll package it up. So you just need to weigh the two off and do you need it and how is it aligned with your own goals.
Yeah, okay. No, very important. Another question here. I'm in Qatar and was declined a mortgage. I have $250,000 in cash that I want to use for a purchase. did I just use the wrong person to look into this?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, going direct to any lender, they've only got one policy, a couple of products sit behind them. They will take your application and submit it, and you get a yes, no, whereas, you know, working with a broker will take your information and sit down, because we've got 35 lenders, work out actually which of these lenders do you qualify with, present those a couple of different options, and then put an application together. So, you know, a real big key is not to submit an application that we don't think's got a 99% chance of getting approved.
If
it's not going to get approved, then we're not going to submit that application, because it's wasting our time, and it's a mark on the borrower's credit file as well.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, it sounds like that's also, you know, relating to, you know, what we discussed in the webinar, lender policy.
Yes.
And then different securities and how they're treated, even suburbs, the types, those sort of things. Can you elaborate a bit more on that from a lender's point of view?
Yeah, so look, you know, you might be an expat and we've got you an application approved for an 80% lend.
Yep.
So they're happy for you, for the expat to put in 20% equity or cash.
Yep.
And the bank's going to lend 80% for that purchase. But then you have to be mindful of, okay, what's the property that you're trying to secure?
Yep.
Some lenders will have what you call postcode restrictions. So if you're in, if you're looking to buy a property in, let's just say Chatswood, New South Wales, or in a Sydney, they might say, because it's a highly density suburb, you know, there's a lot of apartments, we're only going to lend 70% if you're going to buy something in that area.
Yep.
Or if it's a small property, let's say it's smaller than 40 square meters internally, or it's a unique property, like it's a kind of half farmstead and it's got some acreage, they might say, look, we're only comfortable lending based on that category of 60 or 70%. So what I would say is it's important to get pre-approved, make sure you can service that loan, but have a chat to us around what are you actually looking at.
Is it
a standard four bedroom house in Gold Coast? Well then it should be fine, but if it's something unique, let us know. We can check with that lender as well to make sure they'll actually lend against that security.
Yeah, okay. No, some important considerations there. Yeah, I think it just goes to show that the mortgage process isn't that simple.
No.
Not at all. Another one here, which I mean, I've seen before and you might have. Can I use equity in my Australian house to refinance and take cash overseas to purchase a property? So it sounds like they're talking about maybe an equity drawdown or something like that.
Yeah, so, you know, this is where anti-money laundering comes into effect.
Yep.
You know, whenever you're moving money across borders, that's a higher risk. So if you're looking to, if you've got equity in an Australian property and you want to buy something, let's say the US, a property to live in, you know, it could, the bank could assist. They'll want to see the contract to sale on the US end, just to make sure they've got control over where those funds are going, because again, it's a higher risk when you start to cash out and take something abroad. So yes, but there's a lot of sort of hoops you have to jump through.
Okay, so you can do it though.
Yes.
It's just obviously making probably sure that the security, the original Australian house, the issue with LVR and those sort of things.
Making sure that stacks up, making sure you can service, you know, if you need to take a loan on the overseas end, making sure you can service both loans at the same time. Because the bank needs to make sure we can afford, you know, both properties.
Yeah, of course. No, that's important. One of the other ones that I've got here is, it's an interesting one. It's a good question though. I'm about to become an expat. Do I need to refinance or should I keep my owner occupier rate? It's a good question because I know a lot of people wouldn't think about this.
Yeah, so, you know, in your loan contract, it will say that you need to update the lender of any changes to your residential circumstances.
So,
you got to notify them if you move out of that owner-occupied, because I guess some people might not realise that owner-occupied loans and investment loans are priced differently.
Yep.
So the lender will have different capital requirements based on that type of lending. So it's more expensive for them, it requires more capital to lend out investment loans, and even more expensive to lend out interest-only, because regulatory-wise they have to hold more capital and get more balance sheet funding. So you really shouldn't notify them if you're going to change overseas, but if you decide not to, that's up to the borrower.
Yeah.
But I would recommend having a chat to them, renegotiating before you leave it for overseas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think personally, if I was on a pretty good rate and I'm about to head overseas, I wouldn't want to go and let the bank know, oh, I'm about to go overseas, I'm about to be an expat in a high-risk country. What do I need to refinance? Oh, yeah, you know, James, you know, you're on 3.0%. You're going over there, it's going to be 4.5%.
Yeah.
I wouldn't probably mention until it comes about. If it does ever come about, it's likely you'll probably refinance in 3 years' time anyway. 2 years maybe. So I probably would just leave it as is, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're getting a good deal, I think not many people would think to update their bank to let them know that. And once they sort of have an understanding of the investor rate that's going to apply there, they sort of go, shit.
But just keep in mind, if they go down that pathway, and then whilst they're overseas, let's say they're paying principal interest on that loan, they want to change their loan terms to interest only.
Yeah.
That will trigger a full credit reassessment.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
And at that point, obviously, they'll understand, okay, well, you're generating foreign income, so you're not leaving the property, so that will raise a lot of flags at that stage.
Yeah, and that's probably when you'll get the higher interest rate. Correct. On you. Yeah, okay. You make an interesting point there about foreign income. And, you know, while it's something we touch base on the webinar, you know, a lot of expats, when they're working in tax-free zones, Middle East, US, whatever it might be, they've usually got a base salary, and then they're lucky enough to have these allowances thrown on for living costs, rental, private health, whatever it might be, and then bonuses as well. How do lenders treat different currencies as well as different sort of wage structures?
Yeah, so obviously what we'll get is a copy of your contract employment.
Yep.
And quite often it'll have listed your base salary, plus it'll note any allowances. Now, from a base salary point of view, the lenders will convert the foreign income into Australian dollars and then shade it by 20% generally and use that for servicing. Allowance a little bit different because depending on the lender, some are comfortable to shade it by a further 20% and then take that gross amount. Some only take half and some just say, oh, look, that's not acceptable because when you think about the credit team sitting in these Australian banks, if you think about the Australian PAYG employee, generally it's base.
Yep.
You know, our employers don't pay for our insurance unless you've been relocated to maybe mining. You know, where they don't pick up your rental expense, they don't pick up kids' schooling fees. So a lot of those types of income is just completely foreign to them.
Even though you're on a good wicket, they might.
Their credit policy just won't accept that. It's a matter of working with lenders that are open to accepting that.
Yep.
And on top of that, also thinking about your bonus income. So if you've been paid a bonus, and particularly if you're in America, that can be anywhere between 20 to 50% of your base.
Yeah.
If you've been paid a bonus the last 2 years, we can use that income for servicing. So that can definitely open up your borrowing capacity. But the other thing to consider is if you're living in an area where it's a lower cost of living, and we've gone through, you know, it's $1,000 US a month to live for a family of two or three.
Yep.
The Australian lenders will apply HEM, so that is your basically a benchmark of living expenses.
Yeah, okay.
And that won't change. So maybe for a family of three, they'll go, okay, it's $3,500 Australian dollars a month.
We're going to use that instead.
We're going to use that. So that's going to significantly decrease your borrowing capacity.
And did they also look at incomes? You probably mentioned it, but there's a lot to take in, to be honest.
Yeah.
They treat your income almost like it's Australian source as well. So they factor in tax rates as well, is that right?
Yeah, so most lenders will still apply the Australian tax rates against it. So if you're living and working in a country that has a low tax rate, your net tax is going to be a lot higher than what some of these banks will assess it at.
Yep.
There are a few lenders that will accept a net of income for servicing. So obviously, if we're using those lenders, your borrowing capacity is a lot higher.
Yeah, so that's great for people, you know, tax-free environments, UAE, those sort of places. I think you previously mentioned on the webinar about a 20% shade or something like that. I think it was about servicing or something like that regarding the currency.
Yes, so as I was saying, you'll convert, let's say it's from US dollars to Australian, the FX spot rate.
Yep.
And then I'll shade that by 20%. And that's really just to kind of factor in any current and future fluctuation. So let's just say in 2 years' time, because of the assessments done at the time of application, and the Aussie and the versus the Australian, it's trading at 68 cents.
Yeah.
And then in a couple of years' time, the Australian dollar strengthens to 72.
Yep.
Well, that assessment's kind of factored in that movement.
Yeah, okay. It's a huge margin of error, though, that they're factoring in. Yeah. 20%, like.
Well, it's the banks are being conservative.
Yeah, it makes sense. Okay. No, that's good. I mean, I don't have actually any other questions that I want to drill out. I mean, most items we've covered in the webinar, and this has been great to do this Q&A, obviously. Again, you know, Jeremy Harper, hfinance.com.au. He's an expat mortgage specialist. We use him in-house here as well. And to learn more, there'll be a few links, obviously, under the blurb of this. As another update, Brett Evans, the other managing director, is currently in Dubai now, all up and running and set up. So if you're in the Middle East and you want to catch up with Brett, he's obviously got the office there in Dubai, so do reach out to him. And in the meantime, we'll see you on the socials, and appreciate your time, Jeremy.
All right, thank you. Cheers.